Welcome to the Global Research NewsHour. I'm Steve Lindman, brought to you by globalresearch.ca. And today I'm delighted to have on Webster Tarpley. Webster is an author, a journalist, a lecturer, an outspoken critic of U.S. foreign and domestic policy. His newest book, in its second edition, I've got it right in front of me, it's titled Surviving the Cataclysm. Need I explain? But I'll give you the subtitle. That'll explain it. Your Guide to the Greatest Financial Crisis in Human History. We'll talk about the book. We want to talk about a few things. Webster sent me some material. We want to talk about it. He sent me a 5-point program to end the Depression, to restart the world economy. And he's got an 8-point emergency action program for California. So we want to get to as much of that as possible. Webster, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
Oh, I'm delighted to have you on. Now we got three things on the table, so you're the guy involved in this. I'll let you choose. Which one first?
Well, maybe just to define our present world situation with some reference to this book. We are now in a world economic and financial depression. And it is more serious than some other things that might have been called depressions, because it's a crisis of disintegration. It's not merely a collapse. A collapse would be something like the crash of 1929 or the crash of 1987 or the coming the collapse of the dot-com bubble. Those were collapses, but after that, some form of the status quo returned, even despite tremendous losses. But this is a disintegration. It has already destroyed the U.S. and British banking systems, and a significant part of the world banking system are now in the status of what we call zombie banks. They are purely parasitical institutions that do not lend. They only trade, speculate. They essentially drive up the price of oil and cause various kinds of mischief. But they don't do any lending for plant and equipment or even commercial financing. They're purely parasitical entities. And that would be about the top 10 money center banks, Wall Street banks. And beyond this, the perspective that I think we have for the next several years is some form of a disintegration of the U.S. dollar, a cataclysmic crisis there, probably in the form of hyperinflation of the U.S. dollar. And that hyperinflation event is not a domestic event. It doesn't have so much to do with the domestic money supply, but it has rather to do with this dollar overhang, the $4 to $5 trillion U.S. dollars that are sloshing around, the trillion in China, the trillion in Japan, trillion in the Middle East, the oil producers, a trillion maybe in Europe and the rest of the world. And at some point, that's so unstable that really cannot maintain itself. And some kind of an outside event, some kind of a military defeat or any number of other things completely extraneous to this narrow definition of economics could bring on that crisis. So,
Webster, we have a break in just a moment. We have a few commercial breaks. You'll hear the music come on. I absolutely agree with you that we are in really a cataclysmic situation. The world has never faced what we're going through now. And you and I would agree that forecasting is a very, very hazardous occupation. And I love the quote about economists, professional economists, saying they don't forecast because they know. They forecast because they're asked. Because you never know what unexpected events can come up that can shift something in another direction. And we may have a serious hyperinflation problem in the future, Webster. I think right now we're going through a deflationary cycle, but at some point with all this money sloshing around, anything could happen. Let's take a break and we'll come right back.
This is Cascadia Public Radio.
Hour on with Webster Tarpley on the economic depression crisis, call it what you will. It's a pretty serious situation. Wester, let me just put in a quick plug for your book. We can talk about it more later, and then I'll let you pick up. It's extremely detailed. The second edition just came out mid-year, and it says on the back, if you read one book on economics, let it be this one. Well, you've got so much in it that readers will come away with a wealth of information. But let me let you pick up from where you left off.
Let me also say, though, on the issue of forecasting, I think I've done pretty well on forecasting. The parts of the book, and it's the older part that's being reissued, is a snapshot of the crisis as it was in 1998 to 99. And I essentially say that the derivatives bubble is going to bring down the banking system with the connivance of the Federal Reserve and of course, Wall Street generating the entire problem. And I think that's basically what has happened. And I think that's a good way to lead into what is the cause of the of the depression. There's a tremendous obfuscation about this. Economics, I think, is a bankrupt profession. I have a PhD in history, and I look at economics. I would say this is probably the most corrupt pseudo-discipline that we've had. It's divided between monetarists on the one side, the Chicago boys, the Austrians, the von Hayek, von Mises gang. I think they're bankrupt. And then you have the Keynesians, and these are based on Malthus, and I think they're actually equally bankrupt. It's the difference between, the Chicago school and the, say, somebody like Krugman. And these people, although the Keynesians seem to be more intelligent, when it comes to answers, what to do, they're often as bad or sometimes even worse. In terms of the crisis, this book was written in the shadow of the crisis of 1998-99, which was, they called it the Asian contagion. It was really a dollar contagion at the time. And it led then to the bankruptcy of Russia when the Russians defaulted on their treasury payments, the GKOs. And, of course, then the long-term capital management crisis. Now, that was, I think, the pilot project for what's happening today. Long-term capital management was a hedge fund in Connecticut. It was run by the people who had gotten the Nobel Prize for the Black-Scholes model of valuing derivatives and options the year before, and they essentially went bankrupt in the wake of the Russian crisis and blew a hole of many billions of dollars in the world banking system. Greenspan came in with a backdoor bailout, a crony bailout for them, and that, I think, showed us what had to be changed to avoid the present crisis, because now to fast forward to today, what is it that makes this depression what it is? Why do we have a depression? Why should there be one? Why now? It has to do with this derivatives bubble. Derivatives, of course, are paper based on paper. They're things that you hear about merely through euphemisms, because all the economists and ruling class types and finance oligarchs don't want to say the word derivative. They don't like that word. It frightens them, because they therefore have recourse to things like exotic instruments, toxic derivatives, toxic paper, toxic instruments, complex instruments. Whenever they talk about unwinding, that means derivatives. Whenever they talk about counterparties, that means derivatives. They don't like to talk about derivatives because derivatives make clear who is responsible. The bankers have created this crisis. The Wall Street hedge fund hyenas and zombie bankers and so forth, they're the ones who did it. They're the ones who should pay for the depression. Rather, what you've got coming out of right-wing talk radio, for example, is the idea that poor people caused the crisis. It's absolutely amazing. They say that a bunch of poor people bought subprime mortgages on slum properties, and therefore, when they defaulted, that brought down the U.S. and British banking systems. This is an amazing piece of nonsense, because the amounts that are involved in subprime mortgages are minuscule. What you've got to account for is how do you get from the minuscule losses in subprime mortgages to the bankruptcy of Citibank, and of course, not just that, but Northern Rock and Royal Bank of Scotland and Lloyd's Bank and essentially the whole Anglo-American shebang coming down.
I agree with you that these giant banks, I just, in the U.S., I just refer to them generically as Wall Street, because they're certainly all, if they're not headquartered there, they have big operations there. And I agree with you, they're not banks. They're casinos, but they're even worse than that. I call them a crime syndicate, but I'll let you pick up from that.
But through derivatives, I think the thing to hold on to is the fact that we're in the presence today of a $1.5 quadrillion derivatives bubble. That is to say, 1,500 trillion of derivatives. And these are, again, paper based on paper. These are the side bets. They are instruments based on other instruments. A second layer of paper on top of what people would think of as stocks and bonds. There are two kinds of derivatives, the exchange-traded derivatives. These are the futures and the options. But then you've got the over-the-counter derivatives, the counterparty-to-counterparty type. That would be the structured notes, designer derivatives, as I call them, any kind of a contract between different banks. And this could involve just about anything under the sun. So the Bank for International Settlements estimates that it's about 1.1 quadrillion. My estimate is a bit higher, 1.5 quadrillion. This has been repeated and validated by various people in Europe. French news magazines have gone with the 1.5 quadrillion. Remember that those were all illegal under New Deal regulations. And my method is essentially to go back to the New Deal and through a critical analysis, because it has to be critical, mistakes were made. But to abstract from the New Deal, what is it that you can conclude about today's crisis? Well, the first thing is derivatives should have remained illegal. They were illegal from 1936 to 1982. They were then legalized by Reagan, acting on the advice of Chicago School and Austrian School economists. Milton Friedman undoubtedly had a hand in it. The von Mises, von Hayek tradition was working. That would be the Ron Paul tradition, just to make that part clear. So then they became legal, but there's still a great worry about whether derivatives would be able to stand up in court. So along comes Wendy Graham, the wife of Phil Graham, the Texas senator, the well-known reactionary ogre, I would say. She helps to make them even more legal at the end of the Bush administration. And then there's the faction fight under Clinton. Are derivatives, should they be reportable? Should we even know how many there are? Brooks Lieborn of the Commodity Futures Trading Commission says yes. But the Rubin faction, the Robert Rubin faction, with Summers and the people that we have running the administration today in this department, they say no, derivatives are wonderful. And, of course, Alan Greenspan is also very much in favor of them. And then Phil Graham comes along, the Texas senator, and puts through some final measures to make sure that derivatives go on and on. And now we've got the world being crushed under 1.5 quadrillion. So I would say the first thing you've got to realize is look at this crisis today. Look at the crisis in 1998. It's long-term capital management, a hedge fund selling derivatives, options and futures in their case mainly. But now we've got other things. We've got collateralized debt obligations. We've got credit default swaps, structured investment vehicles, all kinds of mortgage-backed securities, asset-backed securities of all sorts, and this entire plethora of toxic paper. What can be the approach to this? If you look at AIG, AIG is an insurance company. It was brought down by what? Once again, a hedge fund selling derivatives. The AIG hedge fund in London now selling $3 trillion of derivatives last year, more than the gross domestic product of France. And when that blew, that is what has cost the U.S. taxpayer more than anything else. It's the heart of the depression, so to speak. The $180 billion for AIG, including many foreign banks have gotten in on that, that is caused by a hedge fund selling derivatives. So surely we ought to realize you want to get out of this depression, you've got to outlaw hedge funds. You've got to essentially regulate them. Once you regulate them, they're no longer hedge funds. And then find a way to get derivatives out of the world. Ban them outright if you can. Or maybe tax them out of existence is another way to do it, because a modicum of taxation is enough to take the life out of the booze for these speculators. But there should be no doubt about this. It's deregulation that has brought on the depression. The Glass-Steagall abolition, also masterminded by Rubin and company, means that we now have these monstrosities like J.P. Morgan Chase. J.P. Morgan and Chase, a bank, could not have coexisted under Glass-Steagall, but now we see them everywhere. Merrill Lynch has been acquired by Bank of America, and so on down the line. So this is a depression.
Let me throw in a question. Well, we have this beyond comprehension amount of absolute garbage that is literally sinking these organizations and sinking the country and sinking the global economy. How long? No, of course, for the time being, Webster, they've swept this stuff under the table. They don't even talk about it anymore. How long can this go on before they no longer can hide the toxic effects of this? It's like a cancer that you don't treat. And if you don't treat it, sooner or later it's going to kill you.
Well,
how long can this go on before?
We've got to address the Obama regime at this point. My thesis from the beginning with Obama is that he is a wholly owned deployment of these banking circles.
Oh, there's no question about it.
He's somebody who came out of nowhere in the same way that Jimmy Carter did. And when somebody comes out of nowhere and then starts getting hundreds of millions of dollars from Wall Street, the biggest backer of all for Obama seems to have been Goldman Sachs, and he was beating McCain, of course, with all the Wall Street financial institutions. He's a new Jimmy Carter. Jimmy Carter groomed by the Trilateral Commission, by Zbigniew Brzezinski and Paul Volcker, and you've got Obama today with basically the same people. David Rockefeller, maybe not as active as he used to be, but Senator Jay Rockefeller of West Virginia, very much part of this effort. But Brzezinski and Volcker, of course, who's sitting in the White House today as the gray eminence. The policy of the Obama administration is to prop up the derivatives bubble at all costs. And this is tragic because the derivatives bubble cannot be propped up. We're now in a collapsing bubble. In effect, we in the world are navigating around on the inside of a collapsing sphere. So we're in a world of negative economic curvature. It's a $1.5 quadrillion bubble, and Obama has mobilized the latest count, a line of credit of $24 trillion in what I think will be the vain attempt to prop it up. So,
we have to take another break.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network because you can handle the truth.
Welcome back to the NewsHour. On with Webster Topley on the economy. Webster, I fundamentally agree with all that you're laying out, and I want to get into. Imagine if this discussion could be on Bloomberg and on CNBC, places like that, so people would really know what's going on.
But try it.
Well, if they brought you on, you know, it would be for about a 2-minute soundbite, which is impossible to explain anything. But we've got so much ground to cover. Let's get into your 5-point program in the bigger picture, the depression that you see, and then let's shift to what to do about California. But start with the bigger picture.
Well, I think the first, I tried to sum it up as 5 points. And obviously, these points have to be somewhat articulated each one, but more or less it goes in the following way. First point is you got to do something to remove this crushing weight of fictitious capital, which is the speculative bubble. Push that aside so you sort of clear the decks for action. And you can also help your budget in the meantime through the way that you do that. The number one imperative is get rid of derivatives. Now, the short answer is ban them. They were banned. They should be banned. They really are illegal. But you can say delete them, shred them, have the bonfire of the derivatives, the Yule log of the derivatives, whatever it is. In practical terms, the way you want it, you can probably do that best is to tax them out of existence with the Tobin tax. So this is now James Tobin, Nobel Prize winning economist, Yale. In the 70s, when the world monetary system was bankrupted by Nixon and Kissinger, he proposed a tax on the turnover in foreign currency markets. Now, we're talking turnover, not profits, but it's the sales tax. It's anything that is bought and sold, whether it's making a profit or a loss. If it goes across an exchange, it can be taxed. And right now, none of this is taxed. It's the biggest single flow of so-called wealth, paper wealth anyway, in the entire economy. It's the one thing that's not taxed. It's therefore being encouraged. In many states, if you go out and buy groceries, you're going to pay 5 or 7% on your groceries. Certainly in just about every state, if you're going to buy the back-to-school supplies for your children, in California, you're going to pay almost 10% on that. In other states, 7, 5, whatever it is. The bankers pay nothing. We've probably got between 1 and 2 quadrillion of turnover, not derivatives in existence, but turnover of everything, stocks, bonds, mutual funds, options, futures, the entire array of these things. None of that is taxed as a transaction. So impose a 1% Tobin tax, securities transfer tax, at the federal level. If we've got 1 quadrillion of turnover per year, then we're talking about $10 trillion of additional income for the Treasury. With $10 trillion, you can have universal health care. You can stabilize Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid. You can increase the social safety net. You can start paying off the existing national debt. You can return to a situation of economic health. You can make big investments in infrastructure above all. So that would be the number one thing. The Tobin tax as a way of wiping out derivatives. You obviously got to do some other things. Hedge funds have to be illegal. They should be regulated. The Glass-Steagall should be restored so that we split these stock broker operations from commercial banks. Most of the existing Wall Street banks should be seized. Sheila Bair, every Friday at the FDIC, seizes some little bank in Podunk Center somewhere, but never pays attention to the really big ones that are all bankrupt, these derivatives monsters, the zombie banks of Wall Street, meaning Bank of America, Citibank, J.P. Morgan Chase, Wells Fargo, Bank of New York Mellon, all of them are bankrupt. They should be seized, and their derivatives should be canceled as a part of that seizure, triage for the derivatives. You've got to re-regulate financial markets in the sense of restoring the uptick rule, banning short selling, if you don't have it, naked short selling, and also regulating the energy markets, the London oil market in particular. The London ICE should simply be banned. That can be declared as an enemy alien, and no oil that comes through there can be allowed into the United States. That would essentially knock them out. So the first area is this kind of re-regulation, and more or less back to the New Deal standards with some modernization. Now, the second point I think is the most critical, the nationalization of the Federal Reserve, not the abolition of it, because we need that credit-generating capability. We're not proposing to go back to bone and beads and wampum, and we're not going to go back to some mythical free market. There has not been a free market in the United States ever, and in most cases, the free market is something that takes you back to the Paleolithic, quite frankly, the old Stone Age. The hunting and gathering society, if you will, is a free market. But short of that, the notion of a free market is simply a propaganda tool used by right-wing demagogues, notably when they're out of power, as they are today, to try to get back into power. And once they're in power, they forget about that. So the Federal Reserve ought to be nationalized and made into a modern version of Alexander Hamilton's First Bank of the United States or the Second Bank of the United States, supported by Monroe and Henry Clay. There was even an attempt to have a third bank under Daniel Webster, which failed. So go back to that, and what should such an entity do? We need to stop borrowing at the federal level and start lending. The key to it all is federal lending, not federal spending, but federal lending. In other words, don't turn to these zombie banks that cannot and will not provide credit for an expansion, for a recovery. The federal government becomes its own bank. In other words, the nationalized Fed is a Bureau of the Treasury, and pursuant to public laws passed by the Congress and approved by the President, it issues a certain money supply at a certain interest rate, and it would be a 0% federal rate for productive purposes only. And that's
I'm sorry, I'm going to interrupt again for another break. Listeners to this program know that the current Fed is a private banking cartel, and that absolutely has to end.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network. Because you can handle the truth.
Welcome back to the News Hour on with Webster Topley on the economy. One quick sidebar, Webster, then you pick up with more points on this. I want to make it real quick. But because things are so bad economically, so many people are being hurt so badly, so many more millions will be hurt in the months and I suspect years ahead, that what are they doing? I guess there are two main things they could do. One is change the subject. So we have this swine flu fiasco and this absolute poison and this untested experimental toxic drug they want to force on everybody. I don't want to get into that. We'll have other programs on that. And the other possibility, if things get bad enough, is start another war. Now, that really is a distraction. But pick up with your point.
Well, certainly now that Obama has gone below 50%, the door to a new false flag operation, I think, is opening wider and wider.
remember the 9/11 or something.
In Bush's first term, we're at the point of 9/11. In other words, we're at the corresponding point now. We're in August and September very soon, and this is where Bush was already cratering. Obama's now cratering probably more severely. So the people who put all that money into Obama have to say, do we want to let this go on and just let him collapse, or do we give him a shot in the arm, so to speak, with a rally-round effect and some kind of a terrorist event? And then Obama comes out and says, country X did it. Now the countries are different. Now it's Pakistan, Sudan, China, Russia, people like this.
Not Iran. Did you say Iran?
I don't think Iran at all. No, Iran is going to be used. Obama has different plans. These are not your father's neocons. This is the Brzezinski faction. If you saw the coup faction in Iran, the Mousawi Rafsanjani CIA faction, the green color revolution, they're chanting death to Russia, death to China. Death to Russia, death to China. In other words, they're publicly chanting the Brzezinski slogan because that's their mission. They will become a kamikaze puppet. Iran will be used, not attacked, but used. And this is Brzezinski's, this has been Brzezinski's method since he installed Khomeini back in 1978, 79 under Carter. So that was, I think this is a very important shift that has occurred that takes us away from economy. I don't believe there'll be an attack on Iran. What I see is every day an attack on Pakistan, which is 2.5 times bigger, with real nuclear weapons that they actually have. So the fetishism of Iran is for me, it leads into the wrong understanding. Iran is important for Brzezinski, not to attack it, but to use it to attack others, to use it again as a proxy, or as I call it, a kamikaze puppet. But let's just bracket that. We run our second point. The first point was to wipe out derivatives, ban hedge funds, outlaw adjustable rate mortgages. Oh, on the first point, you've got to freeze foreclosures, a five-year freeze, to keep people in their homes in the face of these predatory Wall Street characters. You've got to basically say, for 5 years or for the duration of the Depression, we're going to keep people in their homes. We'll work out the details later, but right now, foreclosure is banned. You can't kick somebody out of their primary residence. If they have more than one, then you can foreclose on some of the secondary ones. The second point again, though, the key question is the generation of federal credit, 0% federal credit. The only trick with this is you've got to do something productive. And this is, for a lot of people, this is a distinction which has been completely lost. We're talking about manufacturing. In other words, industry in the sense of commodity production, tangible, physical commodities, real things, or as they say on television now, stuff, the manufacturing of stuff, of things. Meaning, industry in the sense of manufacturing, farming, agriculture, of course, mining, infrastructure building, energy production, scientific research, and generally speaking, again, physical economics, the production of tangible physical wealth. And if you want to get a loan for that, you're on the inside track. If, on the other hand, you're interested in drug money laundering, prostitution, gambling, financial services, any of this, you go and take your chances in the free market that you admire so much. This is sort of the transfusion side of things, because right now, of course, the zombie banks do not lend. On the other hand, we're in a panic, so nobody's borrowing, and this is now our third point. You've got to have the defibrillator, which is to create a series of infrastructure projects in order to restart the economy in productive terms. And part of this, of course, it implies the reindustrialization and the industrial reconversion of many of these idled auto plants, for example, in North America. The idea here would be you look at the United States, you'd say, well, this is a country at the point of thermodynamic collapse in real terms, not financial terms anymore, but just physical terms. The electricity grid is always at the point of breakdown. Passenger rail, freight rail, commuter rail, all at the point of breakdown. The interstate highway system is like the pockmarked surface of the moon or the Verdun battlefield. You've got sewage systems that are routinely collapsing. The sewage and the water is getting mixed up. So you've essentially got to rebuild the entire infrastructure of the United States, really of North America. So what do you do in this regard? You've lost 1,000 hospitals. We've now fallen below what was considered the minimum Hill-Burton criterion of 1946. They wanted to have 4.5 beds per 1,000. We're now at 3.2. So we would have to build 1,000 modern hospitals in the United States, 500 beds each, get a half million additional beds to make the minimum 1946 level. And in doing that, you'd want to put them in the inner cities where they've been wiped out, in the poorer areas of the inner cities, and then in rural America, in places like the High Plains, in Montana, North Dakota, Wyoming, where essentially a heart attack is now a death sentence because you're so far away from a hospital. It's also amazing that you can have a debate about health care without talking about the fact that you've lost 1,000 hospitals. You would then have to build, in my view, about 50,000 miles of maglev. In other words, rebuild the entire rail system on this idea of the magnetic cushion railway that can get you from New York to San Francisco in 3 hours or something like this, something comparable. Anyway, comparable to an airplane, maybe in the first generation, maybe not quite that fast, but approaching that, and rebuild the entire system, including freight. 1,000 hospitals, 50,000 miles of maglev. Then there's the electricity grid. And I think here the only thing to do, the only thing that's economical, sweeping aside ideology and Malthusianism, is to essentially replace what you've got, which is 100 nuclear reactors, rebuild those as high-temperature, fourth-generation, pebble-bed nuclear reactors, build a high-temperature reactor. The Chinese have it. Everybody, all the other powers in the world are going in this direction. The debate on nuclear energy, I would say, worldwide is over. If you look at India, China, Russia, Europe, even places of great pessimism like Finland, they're going into it. Italy is rethinking their decision. Even in Germany, they're having second thoughts. And then you've got to get into rebuilding the interstate highway system. Under Eisenhower, this was a great thing, greatest road-building project since Rome. But now you've got to rebuild all that because these are getting to be completely unusable. In terms of your water systems, a lot of these are 100 to 150 years old, and you'd have to rebuild all of that. So essentially, very heavy emphasis on infrastructure. You could estimate the infrastructure deficit in North America between 10 trillion, 15 trillion. In Obama's stimulus, we had about 60, 70 billion at most. It should have been a multiple of that. So the other thing then is your science drivers. Without scientific innovation, you don't have a recovery. What has worked well in the past? The space program, of course, has created these spin-offs. A lot of what we assume to be the essence of modern life, the internet and computers, all of these are byproducts of the space program, of the silicon chip and then of the DARPA internet. So let's think about that. Now, right now, I would say an international program for the permanent exploration, colonization, and indeed industrial production on the moon, Mars, and other nearby objects in the solar system, and do that cooperatively with anybody else who wants to join in. A second point would be biomedical research. The only way that you can save money in medical care and avoid genocide is to find cures. In other words, if you can find a cure for cancer, diabetes, heart attacks, and so forth, you can then save money in a way that doesn't involve getting people to die, which seems to be the idea floating around in some of these Obama plans. So you'd have a large-scale sort of Manhattan Project in biomedical research. And your third one, of course, would be high-energy physics to try to finally make the leap into thermonuclear fusion power and other forms of energy that are waiting, I think, beyond that. So you're looking towards the future. So between the infrastructure and the science drivers, this would generate demand for loans. In other words, this is the credit demand side. The subcontractors in the infrastructure are often state governments, local governments. They can be consortia of states and so forth. It's done more or less in the method of the Transcontinental Railway, the Erie Canal. Every other big thing that's ever been done has been this kind of, government programs, because that's the way you get it done. The private sector has had 40 years of reactionary Republican rule to do this, and they haven't done it. So that means they'll never do it. But now you've got to get going as best you can. Of course, Obama is not going to do any of these things because he wants all the money to be available for bailouts for Wall Street, which means the money is just going to be burned away. The fourth point is that when you look at situation of the social safety net, it is in tatters. People thought they had 401ks and IRAs. I believe that most of that is now gone or will be gone. So it means that you've got to have a Social Security pension that you can actually live on in some form of dignity. And that might imply a doubling of the current rate, which is absolutely inadequate, because again, all those stock market based things where the risk was shifted onto the individual person, they're all gone. Similarly, in the healthcare area, what is, I think, salient about this is insurance companies in general are bankrupt. And nobody talks about this. We have a whole healthcare debate about public insurance, private insurance. The private insurance is largely bankrupt. AIG is an insurance company. It's bankrupt with $3 trillion of derivatives and $200 billion from the federal government. The Hartford got $3.5 billion off the TARP, off the Treasury bailout. So you can also look at MetLife, Metropolitan Life Insurance, Allstate, the Prudential, and on and on. Most of these insurance companies are at or near the point of needing bailouts because they have speculated in derivatives. So that means that you've really got to have a government plan as an alternative, probably in the form of Medicare for all, with no rationing of care and no genocidal intent and no board of pointy-headed experts who are going to tell people that they have to die for the bottom line of the system. So you're going to have to expand that. You're going to have plenty of money for unemployment insurance, for food stamps. Right now, the food stamps for an individual is about $125 a month. Try living on that. A family, $250 a month. That's not enough, right? You're going to have problems with the cognitive development of children if they don't get enough protein, and on and on. So the social safety net has got to be fully funded. And I simply do not understand these reactionary Republicans, the broad range, basically any Republican and any libertarian in that area, they come forward and say, well, our ultimate goal is the abolition of the social safety net. Well, you're seeing that in California today, and it is the descent into barbarism. The fifth point, then, is the international dimension. We obviously need a new world monetary system. We need some form of stability in terms of fixed parities among the various currencies. It's simpler now, the euro, the dollar, and the yen, possible Latin American currency, possible Arab world or African currency coming in. Fixed parities, gold settlement among the participating nations, I think, is the way to go, similar to Bretton Woods. But above all, to build into this the idea that capital goods production in Europe, the United States, Japan, and so forth can be restarted with the idea that the recipients of those capital goods are going to be in Africa, South Asia, and the poorer parts of Latin America. So you're essentially tackling the problem of world economic development. And one of the ways you want to do that is the great projects of world infrastructure, right? The Mekong Development Project, the Nile, Congo, the Ganges, Brahmaputra, and so forth. Start building things like the Bering Strait Bridge Tunnel, the Gibraltar Bridge Tunnel, the Sicily to Tunisia, and so forth. In other words, to complete the process of modernizing world infrastructure, which has been on the agenda really since the immediate aftermath of World War II. So with that, you could get a world economic recovery. So those again, the 5 points. Ban derivatives, seize the Fed for 0% lending, start infrastructure and science drivers, maintain the social safety net, especially during the transition in the Depression, and then finally the international monetary reform.
I think it's important to point out also, and we've had discussions in this program about it, Webster, that the government, if only the government could be printing the money, but even the way it is now, the Fed, there could be no limit to the amount of money created, provided it's used for productive use, not to go to banks for casino operations, not to cut down on lending. If money created is used productively to do the kind of things that you're talking about, that would benefit the country, that would benefit people, that would create jobs. Now, what Obama is doing is exactly the opposite of that, is including, my goodness, the so-called stimulus. Well, look at what he's doing to California and all the states. He has stiff-armed the states, so instead of creating jobs, they're firing people, they're cutting social services, they're putting people more in duress than they are now. Nothing is being done to save people's homes. Exactly the most counterproductive policy to get the country back on its feet that I can imagine. I'm sure you too.
And it's very important to do what you've just done, which is you want to attack Obama from the left. The only way you can see what Obama's doing is to approach him from the New Deal standpoint or something like that. This is not Roosevelt. This is the anti-Roosevelt. This is not the New Deal. This is the New Deal in reverse.
Oh, it
the
is.
New Deal is not a matter of giving payments to bankers. Obama's got a credit line of $24 trillion for the banks. And I suppose his out of the stimulus, about $300 billion of the stimulus was actually useful. So that means that under Obama, the bankers are beating the people by about 80 to 1. Those are Obama's priorities. He's a union buster. He has destroyed the United Auto Workers. He's in the process of destroying the American Federation of Teachers. They have given up on any relief for foreclosures. The cram down has now been abandoned. The card check, something I would have welcomed. The card check as a means of restoring some kind of rough parity or equilibrium, or at least some kind of a counterweight to the caprices and excesses of the ownership, right, of the bosses, in crude terms. That's been abandoned. So all of the stuff that Obama had as sort of progressive window dressing has been abandoned. And what you've got now is naked Wall Street power, the government where we have of the bankers, by the bankers, for the bankers. And it means Wall Street. The enemy is Wall Street. The government is merely the terrain where the people confront Wall Street and better mobilize to fight. Because if you just give up on this stuff, then it's not going to work. Let me just bring it on now to California. Obviously, the thing that I object to, the stimulus, I think, is a mixed bag. But the bailout, Obama, of course, supported the bailout. He organized the votes for the bailout. So it was Paulson and Bush demanding it, and Obama delivering, essentially, the Democratic House members, especially the Black Caucus.
We need to take another break. I sum up Obama. I saw it coming before he even took office. I sum him up in three words after 6 months: worse than Bush. We'll come
correct.
Back. We'll come back and we'll pick up on that.
This is RVN, the Republic Broadcasting Network.
Welcome back for a final segment with Webster Topley. So much to cover. We really need another hour. Let's get a little in on California, Webster. California is crucial because if it were a country, it would be the eighth largest in the world. What affects California affects all of America, and it may be the canary in the coal mine. California may be sinking in the Pacific. Maybe the other states will follow. They're virtually all under duress. But talk a little bit about your plan for California.
The first thing is to note that the TARP, the bailout of October 2008, proposed by Bush and Paulson, but then strongly supported by Obama, with, again, arm twisting of the Black Caucus to vote for it when they didn't want to. Obama is married to this TARP, and he has validated it also by bringing one of the main architects of the TARP, the bailout, Geithner, in as the Secretary of the Treasury. So Obama is bailout barky. He's Mr. Bailout in addition to everything else. Now, that was $700 billion or, in some counts, a trillion. That should have been made available for state budgets. In other words, to meet the needs of state budget deficits, to maintain the essential stuff, the Medicaid, state health services, education, police, fire, prisons, the entire array of things that you've absolutely got to have in order to have a civilization. And Obama has basically sacrificed that by giving... He gave the entire trillion, essentially, to Wall Street before he even got into office. So he started off having foreclosed every other thing. So that leaves us now with what can you do? I gave the federal, the national state level program. In other words, what you can do if you're in Washington and you have power, you could do the 5 points that I've just ticked off. If you're in a state, what can you do? Well, you can't really solve the depression as a whole, and it's no use kidding yourself that you can, but you can do a lot. And I would recommend, rather than a lot of blather about states' rights in the abstract, let's talk about concrete things you want to do and get to the content, because states' rights in general is a somewhat dubious slogan. Historically speaking, this has often not been very pretty. But let's get down to cases, right? What is it that you want to do? Here's what I would do. In California, the first thing you want to do is a Tobin tax. You want to have a state-level securities transfer tax. Any state can do this. And again, if we're talking about sacrifice for all and shared sacrifice and we're all in the same boat and Wall Street and Main Street are the same, wonderful. We're overtaxed, right? The tax burden on the average person is much too big. So therefore, let's have a 1% tax on all the turnover, all the speculative transactions of these bankers, meaning derivatives, options, futures, stocks, bonds, foreign exchange, commodities, the entire array of things that they deal with.
Webster, we've got about 1 minute left, so
That would be one thing. That, for California, that would generate several hundred billion dollars, as much as $600 billion for California. You could roll back the cuts and have no budget crisis at all. The second thing you can do is stop foreclosures in your state. You have a state law, no foreclosures for 5 years or for the duration of the crisis. The third thing you can do is what Bernie Sanders tried to do in the Senate. He tried to have a usury law with a 15% roof on a top rate on a credit card. This was defeated, but he got 33 votes. A state could come forward and say, we're going to stop these zombie bankers from squeezing our citizens by imposing what many states used to have, a 10% usury law. So those three things. And then, of course, the rest of it is what your state is going to do vis-a-vis Washington.
Oh, indeed, and we've run out of time. There's so much more we could go into. I hope you'll come back and we can
do this
again.
I'd be delighted, and thank you for having me here
today. Oh, thank you, Webster. This is not going away in a hurry. We're going to be talking about this months from now, a year from now, 2 years from now. It's very ugly. Join us again tomorrow. Again, Webster, many, many thanks.
Join us again tomorrow.
We'll be back at the economy again. Please do come back. Join us every day.